This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Happy Friday, everyone. Let's dive straight into our week in review, beginning with President Trump's new tax plan. It was heralded by Treasury Secretary Steven Mnuchin.
This is going to be the biggest tax cut and the largest tax reform in the history of our country. And we are committed to seeing this through.
However, it was lambasted by Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer.
The president's outline yesterday is a direct assault on the middle class and an expensive gift to the wealthiest Americans and the special interests.
We'll talk about the new tax plan and the rest of the week's news with our Week in Review team. Today, it's Jim Sturgis, Executive Director of the Pioneer Institute. Jim, it's great to see you again.
It's good to see you.
Also with us, Tom Keene, former Boston City Councilor and contributor to WBUR's Cognoscenti Ideas and Opinions page. Tom, it's great to see you as well.
Pleasure to be here.
Okay, so how much do you both love President Trump's new tax plan? Jim?
I actually like quite a lot of it. Well, you know, I'm a small government guy,
Yep. And
that makes, I think, a lot of sense. I think there are parts of it I don't like, and maybe it's more interesting to focus on that.
Okay.
Often it's said that the Republicans are deficit hawks. This cuts in a completely different direction. It shows that Republicans are just like Americans in that they don't like to pay for free lunches.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of free lunch in that tax plan.
I've seen that one estimate said it could add $4 trillion to the deficit in a decade.
There are some that say even up to 6.2. Now, this, to be fair, this is not a spending plan. But I think what you find is that Paul Ryan is going to have a very different view because he wanted to have something that was tax neutral to some degree. So,
right.
You know, this is going to be an interesting one where the president's team, the coneheads, you might call them, the Gary Coneheads, have really taken control of this agenda. It is definitely an agenda that's focused on growth. There's a lot of good in that, but they've set up a whole number of traps in that all the bad stuff that has to be done in the negotiation is going to have to come through the House.
Uh-huh. Okay. So, Tom, I mean, what do you make of this idea that this $4 to $6 trillion addition to the deficit we've heard over the course of this week, I mean, especially from the Treasury Secretary, that he says it's going to be all offset by massive amounts of growth.
Right. Just 10% GDP growth a year, and I think we're all set, right?
So we just become China. China circa 2010.
So if you look at the first quarter GDP numbers, which were not very good in terms of growth, we got a long ways to go because our rate, I think, was at less than 1% annually. You know, what the Trump administration is saying is that you need at least 3% growth, and they argue that with 3% growth, somehow this becomes revenue neutral. Obviously, we haven't seen the numbers. And it's important to stress that basically what this tax plan is a one-page document, a series of bullets. It's almost impossible, really, to even analyze what this is going to do.
Because it is literally one page right now.
Right. It's literally one page. And there's things in here, for example, the 15% corporate tax rate, which is, I think, actually generally a great idea because our corporate tax rate is way too high compared to the rest of the world. But it also means that individuals are going to cleverly figure out a way to suddenly become corporations or LLCs themselves and therefore not be paying 25% or 30% or 35%, but rather 15%. So if that happens, then the impact on this in terms of the Treasury is dramatically greater.
Yeah. So let me just play some tape here because I've mentioned him a couple of times, Treasury Secretary Steven Mnuchin. Here he is at a press conference on Wednesday talking about all that growth we were mentioning earlier.
The economic plan under Trump will grow the economy and will create massive amounts of revenues, trillions of dollars in additional revenues.
On the other hand, on Wednesday, we also spoke with Richard Parker. He's a lecturer in public policy at the Harvard Kennedy School of Government, definitely on the liberal side of the scale here. He says that the historical data don't show or don't support the basic theory behind supply-side economics. And he said that tax cuts haven't historically shown great amounts of growth.
Does this kind of tax policy, in fact, grow the economy dramatically better than other tax policies? We have a lot of data on that, and the answer is, I think, pretty conclusively no.
Jim, this is something we're going to be hearing a lot of in the coming weeks and months, and I just want to know what your take on this, what history shows us for these kind of tax plans.
Well, look, I think this is the problem. Tax doesn't drive everything. So one of the great things that happens with this plan that is also only on one page is that it cleans out a lot of the barnacles that have accumulated over 30 years and all the different tax giveaways and that sort of thing. It streamlines things enormously, and I think it makes it much more attractive to someone who's entering into the business creation business, if you will. But the history on this is checkered. I think if you take a look at the Reagan years, it was pretty good. But this has a lot in similar with the Bush tax cuts. There wasn't as much clean out of the barnacles that they're aiming for.
Right.
But it was on a 10-year window, just like this, because they have to go through a Senate reconciliation process. And the evidence from the Bush years is not very good. So if this is the only thing they're going to be doing, and this is how they're going to drive growth, I think the train's not going to move nearly as fast. It's to Tom's point earlier, if they're aiming for 3 or even 3.5% growth, just tax policy, no way it's going to do it.
It's not going to do it enough. It's not going to be enough, at least. So Tom, let me just drive straight at what I think is at the heart of the long-running debate over taxes in the United States. The Trump plan, the one-page plan, as we know of it, says it's going to clean out all those barnacles, as Jim was talking about, getting rid of all those deductions.
And it looks like that.
Except for a couple of the most popular ones, mortgage and interest deduction, for example. It's also reducing the tax brackets down to 10, 15, and 35%. Yeah. And doing other things, eliminating the estate tax, for example. So there's a lot to dig into each one of those points, a lot to like, maybe a lot to not like. But overall, I think one of the big criticisms we're going to hear or are already hearing about the tax plan is that just like the Bush tax cuts, the consolidated effect is a tax cut for the wealthiest Americans, not much change for middle and middle class Americans. And therein lies the problem.
Right. So the tax rates are coming down. So that clearly is going to benefit those who are the wealthiest. The fact that you eliminate the estate tax or what is often called the death tax, I guess it depends upon what side of that aisle you're on. The fact that you're going to eliminate that plainly only at this point, that only affects the wealthiest of Americans as well. So Democrats are exactly right, which is to say that rich people are really going to benefit disproportionately. The big concern about the 10-year time frame here is that the way this is supposed to pay for itself is that business starts making these huge long-term investments. But you don't make long-term investments if it's only a 10-year. And remember, 1 year in, it's only a 9-year. So that's all you have. You have a very short time frame in terms of making those investments. The payback on them usually isn't that short. And as a consequence, you're not going to get the growth you wanted. So you have this plan that intends to pay for itself because of what I think is a good strategy with regard to corporate taxes. But it's really paying for the tax cuts for a lot on wealthy people.
Jim, last thought on taxes to you.
No, the only thing I'd say is for all of us who are here in Massachusetts listening to WBUR and talking at WBUR, for Massachusetts and California, New York, and other high-tax states, it's probably not a very good thing for even the upper middle class and the wealthy in the sense that the federal deduction for state taxes goes away as part of this, as one of the things they want to do to help defray the cost of it. So if you're in a low-tax environment at the state level, it's great for you. For us, not nearly as good.
And remember what this is all about, okay? Doing away with this is a big shot right at the states that did not vote for Donald Trump. It is the urbanized states, California, New York, and Massachusetts, who are going to bear the brunt of this. States that voted for Donald Trump, which don't have any state income tax at all, feel no pain on this. Here, where we're paying state income taxes, effectively we will be paying a third more than we are right now.
Yeah. Well, much as I'm sure listeners would love us to talk tax policy for the entire week in review, let's move on and discuss another action that the Trump administration announced this week. On Wednesday, the president signed an executive order directing the Interior Department to review national monuments or the existence of national monuments larger than 100,000 acres and those specifically created since 1996. Here's the president.
The Antiquities Act does not give the federal government unlimited power to lock up millions of acres of land and water, and it's time we ended this abusive practice.
The president basically calling the use of the Antiquities Act a land grab. Now, this order could really have an impact here in New England because we've got the first ever marine monument off our shores, the Northeast Canyons and Seamounts Marine National Monument. That was created in 2016 by President Obama, and here he is announcing the marine monument.
We're protecting fragile ecosystems off the coast of New England, including pristine undersea canyons and seamounts. We're helping make the oceans more resilient to climate change, and this will help fishermen better understand the changes that are taking place that will affect their livelihood. And we're doing it in a way that respects the fishing industry's unique role in New England's economy and history.
That was President Obama in September of 2016. So, Jim, let me just start with you. I mean, obviously two very starkly different takes on the purposes of national monuments in America. What do you think of the review?
The review will be bottled up in court
for
quite some time. So this is one we're going to come back and talk about repeatedly. I mean, I think one of the things we've seen in the first 99 days of the Trump administration is that his own party has acted to some degree as a break, however you want to put that. The courts have certainly acted as a break. And in this case, they certainly will get involved. My own take on the one issue that's raised as regards Massachusetts, that's a Marine monument, is, and I work with Gina McCarthy, have a lot of respect for her. Full disclosure, I took her place at the state level. I afterwards work with her to some degree. I know this is sort of a Gina McCarthy special in the sense that I don't.
Former EPA administrator.
Former EPA administrator. The fishermen and the communities that were most affected on the economic side were not sounded out in terms of what their opinions were on this, what it might do to them, I believe, sufficiently. I think there was a smart way to do this, and I hope that during the review there's a smart outcome which takes some of the good stuff that comes with the protection of that monument, but also facilitates a little bit of that industry, which is so important to the southeastern part of the state.
Yeah, the naming of this monument was quite controversial here in Massachusetts. But let me just, before I go to you, Tom, let me just play another piece of tape here, because we've got Interior Secretary Ryan Zinke. He was at a press conference with the president on Wednesday, really speaking to this issue of what happens when the government names a new national monument.
Monument designations have placed public lands off limits for grazing, fishing, mining, multiple use, and even outdoor recreation. Somewhere along the way, the act has become a tool of political advocacy rather than public interest.
So, Tom, here's my question. I mean, the president is having a review of the monuments named since 1996. I think that's a nod to the fact that, given some time, most Americans like the monuments they've got once they realize that, hey, you know, it's been 5, 10, 15, 20 years, I don't know. We don't necessarily want a mountaintop to get blown up for mining, because we like the fact that it's still preserved
it's still
in nature.
Yeah. Exactly. I think that's right. Americans really like this. On the other hand, if you go back and read the 1906 Antiquities Act, which I did.
And you have brought here with you,
and I brought it with
fact.
Me. It's about as long as the tax plan. if you go back and look at it, you'll actually see that it really doesn't give the president that much authority. It really talks about when you protect lands, it's really supposed to be very narrowly drawn to protect kind of antiquities and not millions and millions of acres, which it's been done for. So I understand the argument people are making, which is that presidents have basically used this and kind of, you know, driven a bus right through this thing and taken advantage of it. On the other hand, Jim's exactly right, that if you try to undo this at this point, the act appears to give whatever the president did doesn't seem like it can be undone by another president saying, no,
right.
I want to reverse course. It looks to me like it has to go through Congress, and that probably won't happen.
Mm. Well, I just want to play another piece of tape here, because there's another New England national monument that's going to fall under this review, and that's the Mount Katahdin, or I should say the Katahdin Woods and Waters National Monument, 87,000 acres, and it was designated by President Obama. Maine Governor Paul LePage said this week that he plans to go to Washington next Monday to testify before Congress to have the monument's status revoked. Here's Governor LePage.
The legislature in Maine had a resolution that said they did not want a national park or monument. The governor weighed in, did not want it. We had local referendums that said they didn't want it, and he did it anyways. That's a violation of the Antiquities Act.
Jim, just your thoughts there.
I think it's going to be a long road for him as well. I mean, at the end of the day, they're going to have to sue even in that situation. I just don't see how they can win that.
Somehow the lawyers always win,
well,
right?
Particularly
no matter
this
what
administration.
Side, no matter what side.
One thing to consider is this, though. You can also modify the designation, and that's, I think, the direction they may want to go. And it looks to me like under the Antiquities Act, it's very possible to change it. So, for example, you might want to allow fishing where you're not allowing fishing
yeah.
without doing away with with the national park itself. That actually might happen. I suspect that's what we're going to see out of this review.
So says Tom Keene, who has brought the Antiquities Act with him. Never say that our Week in Review panelists are not well-researched here. All right, so let's actually move a lot closer to the center of town here and talk about what's going on regarding shadows. Because on Wednesday, the Boston City Council voted 10-3 to approve a proposal that would allow construction of the Millennium Tower on the site of the Winthrop Square Garage. Now, it's supposed to be 775 feet, so building the tower would violate current state laws that govern shadow on Boston Common and the Public Garden. Here's Councilor, City Councilor Tito Jackson, and mayoral candidate, I should say, who was one of the three councilors who voted no.
This is about the soul of the city of Boston and a question of, is the soul of the city of Boston, the future of the city of Boston, and how we leave it for our children for sale. And I will be voting no to emphatically say that is not for sale.
Councilor Sal LaMattina had really hit back, saying the sale of the site for the tower brings a lot of needed revenue for the city.
Just to be serious, this is really good for the city. It's going to help people in my neighborhood that live in the most oppressive housing units in the city. I think that's a good thing. I'm not selling my soul. I will sell my soul if it's going to help poor families live in decent housing. Yes, I sold my soul.
Before we get to our discussion about this, if any members of the city council are hearing, we here at WBUR have some audio experts who could really help you with the audio of your live feeds. We appreciate that you're live feeding the council meetings, but help us out with this audio here. Okay, all right. Shadows on Boston Common because of the Millennium Tower. Jim, what's your take here?
My take is it's been really fun to read the Boston Globe because it's been a food fight over there yeah. on all sides of the issue. And Dante Ramos's piece today, who's a columnist there, is it's pretty severe. Ralph Waldo Emerson, he was actually talking about shadows when he came up with this quote. He said that a foolish consistency is a hobgoblin of little minds. He talks about how you focus on the shadow on the wall. In this case, I think that's kind of what I see in this issue. The serious part of this, there were multiple bidders. The amount of shadow that's going to be cast is limited. It's probably up to 90 minutes max per day, and it's usually in the morning, very early. What concerns me about it is this. This is one-time revenue, and will they apply it to one-time revenue type stuff like capital investments? What's the plan for using the money? And it feels to me a little too much like the mayor's office is responding and saying, we're going to try and build support by saying, we'll give a little to this, a little to that. It would be really wonderful to say, here's really what we want to do for all the parks in Boston. Mm. And this is the change it would make across the city, including also the Boston Common, which deserves some sort of mitigation. But what are we going to do for the rest of the city to make sure that people actually feel the effect, the benefit of this?
Good question. And by the way, you two are too polite. You ought to be correcting me here because there's so much development going on. I'm getting all the towers confused here. It is the Winthrop Square Tower. Yep. I called it the Millennium Tower on accident.
Well, it's because Millennium was the winning bidder.
Yeah, exactly. So, Tom, tell me, you love shadows? Shade.
Shade.
As Jim Sturgis is throwing, he's throwing a lot of shade about.
So I will tell you, I don't think anybody's soul was sold in this. I mean, it is really important for people who want to take a look at this issue to actually look at the graphics of what's going on. There are already, in the morning, shadows across the Boston Common and the Public Garden. This adds a little bit more shadow. Not a lot more shadow, a little bit more, and Jim's exactly right. It's not on every day of the year. In fact, most days of the year it doesn't happen, and it's only during the morning for a short amount of time. So it just strikes me the whole thing has been overblown. Getting to the money point, however, yeah. The big concern here, it seems to me, is that what you really have is a lot of money coming in for a guy who's running for mayor. And it is a great way to make sure you're going to get reelected as mayor, to have a lot of dollars to dole out to make sure people are really happy with you. And that's actually kind of a concern because you spend all this money and then a couple of years later, you don't have the money in place to be able to, say, keep that refurbished park actually operating in a refurbished manner.
Jim, what do you think about that?
No, I think that's absolutely right. You could use this. One way you could use this, for example, is to set up a revolving fund of some kind that provides for the maintenance and upkeep of the parks well into the future, right? And it's a fund from which you draw the interest or something like that. But that kind of long-term thinking about what a one-time opportunity so right. that people enter perpetuity can actually say, that was actually a wonderful thing for the city. We made an exception for that. Otherwise, we're going to spend it. I mean, this is what we do, right? We spend money and we don't have much to look back for.
We'll spend anything. We're going to be looking for the next big hit out somewhere.
Yeah. Well, I want to play one more piece of tape. This is Liz Visa. She's the executive director of the Friends of the Public Garden, and she spoke to WBUR on Monday.
Approving this home rule petition sets a precedent and a blueprint for future projects, and the city can't guarantee that another developer with more money put on the table to entice the city would be open to exempting those laws for the future as well.
So, I mean,
yeah, this is the, you know, the nose, the camel's nose under the tent, that, oh, you, if you make one exception, then you'll always have to make exceptions. I just don't buy that. It's okay to make one exception and live with that. And it doesn't mean you're going to have to make another exception in the future.
Jim?
Look, if a developer came by and said, I'm going to give you $300 million next time for something that will put 30 minutes of shadow on the common.
You'd say sold.
I would say that's worth considering, but yeah.
Okay.
I don't think this has to go. Just remember, this doesn't have to just get approved by a city council. It has to go through the legislature.
Yes.
And the legislature is not going to willy-nilly just say exemption. It's just not going to happen.
Yeah. It'd be amazing to see a flurry of great activity on Beacon Hill of some kind. That's me throwing shade. That's my shade for the day. All right. So we've got just enough time here for our hubbubs. And those are the stories that maybe didn't hit the top of the news, but we think deserve a little airtime anyway. So, Tom, first to you.
Okay. Good news, everybody. UMass Boston just won the state's highest award for eco-friendly commuting. Of course, the reason so many people bike, walk, or use public transit to UMass Boston is because there's no parking on campus. The main campus garage is so dilapidated, it's unusable. It's kind of funny. We have this love-hate relationship with cars. We love ours, but we think others should use some other mode of transit. And you can see that in policies that try to reduce the use of cars. Sometimes those are inadvertent, as in the case of UMass Boston. Other times they're intentional, as is the case with new residential developments now built without parking at all. Personally, I'm a big fan of cars. Nothing else gives us the same degree of mobility and freedom. Plus, nothing else gives us the privacy to sing off-key at the top of our lungs. That eco-friendly award, it's not a sign of success, but rather a failure. UMass Boston is now in trouble with big deficits largely due to declining enrollment. Fix the garage, give people an easy way to get there, and the students will return. UMass Boston may end up a little less eco-friendly, but the institution itself will be thriving.
Oh, good hubbub, Tom. Okay, Jim, can you match that one?
Well, the only way to match is to go back 5,000 years. Kepler said that the universe, as of yesterday, was created.
I want you to note that you quoted both Emerson and Kepler on the show today.
Dude, there's more where that came from. So I actually want to focus on something different, which is yesterday's resumption of a tradition that would make Neapolitans proud and would provoke sharp disagreement from the craftsmen at the North Bennett Street School, and that is MIT students have brought back the musical equivalent of cow tipping, piano throwing.
Oh, yeah.
I'd like to note that the piano fell flat, and the students decided to use the event for charitable purposes, and I hope it was a smashing success.
Very sharp of you. Piano throwing. Okay, so I went through this long spate of doing either wacky science or animal hubbubs, and now I'm back on the animal side of things because the Massachusetts State Police on their Facebook page very lovingly put up some photos of, you know, if you didn't read the caption, you'd say, why is a state trooper walking a llama down a highway? Well, apparently, the troopers Matthew Kane and Kyle Minicucci, and I'm sorry if I said your name wrong, trooper, but they responded to a call this is from the Massachusetts State Police Facebook page, of a llama out on the lam, which they spelled L-A-M-B. But the troopers had some rope in their car. They managed to harness the llama and take it to safety. So well done, Massachusetts State Troopers. And good job with the puns on your Facebook page. Jim Sturgis and Tom Keene, thank you so much for joining us today. Have a great weekend.
Thank you.
We'll be back. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.